Hello and welcome to another episode of the podcast.
Woo!
Welcome.
I'm Daniel Pritchett.
Jesse Brown.
We gotta start over.
Time out.
I'm Ben Robin.
I'm still Daniel Pritchett. Today we are talking about code quality and engineering practices.
So let's get right into it.
Yeah.
So as Daniel said, this is kind of about engineering practices more than anything else, I guess. And along with that comes like tools and things like that.
Yes.
So what's the, I guess, Daniel, what's the biggest red flag coming into like a new project that would like be your worst nightmare?
So it's kind of a sliding scale. If I show up on a project and they have continuous deployment to a staging server that only deploys after a real test suite passes, then I'm in a good place. But that really doesn't happen as much as we'd like it to. So if I'm on a project that, say, doesn't use a modern version control system, that's probably terrible.
Yeah.
Another one is
terrible.
Yeah, that's good enough. We'll start there.
Yeah, that's where I was going to start. Source control. Like,
yeah,
we shouldn't spend too long on it because if you're listening to this, you're probably already using source control.
Table stakes. Like, it's a given that you should be using it.
But yeah, and Daniel said modern source control. I think that's important as well. I mean, I groan if I have to get on a project that uses like Subversion. I know Subversion is still very popular for certain types of projects, but
right,
for most web projects and like desktop projects, it's pretty antiquated.
Yeah.
So what would be modern versions, like Git? What else? TFS?
Just any
Mercurial
distributed stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, distributed cool. Is the main thing.
Great.
I believe there's reasons to use the old ones if you have giant binaries and that's a
key
part of your
studios
workflow.
Yeah, game studios and people like Google, they use like their own sort of source control that's built on top of other protocols, I'm sure, just because they have different problems than you and me. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about why we brought this topic up and like what it does to your day or week or entire project from a work perspective. Like what happens when you have it and what happens when you don't?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is if they don't have source control and you fix something and you deploy it and you break everything, you don't really know why because you don't really have a history of exactly what changed.
What changed, yep.
And so you can accidentally change something in production because you were like testing with your local and you had a local config and you accidentally deployed that. And now you're trying to point at localhost from Heroku or something. And you're like,
right,
well, that doesn't work. I think that's my main thing is, and also just having a history of the file system. If you see some really weird like code, you're like, why does this exist? Being able to answer that is super important.
Oh man. Being able to track line by line, like the history of this line of code in this file and the evolution of this module over a whole source control history is just amazing for understanding not just who made this decision, but hopefully why and what the situation was at the time.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the code cleanup we've been doing this week on one of our bigger projects without source control?
No.
That would be terrifying.
I think we've done like 200,000 or 300,000 deletions.
Yes.
Because it's sort of like a version project that like, you know, it was legacy code brought in and started rewriting.
Yeah.
And while they rewrote the code, it wasn't cleaned up as it was rewritten because it was sort of like dual purpose, and that's okay. But cleaning it up at the end of the day felt really good, but it would have been impossible without source control.
Right.
Trying to figure out, oh, this hasn't been modified in a year, and I don't see anything linking to it. It's probably safe to get rid of.
Is that easier with the statically typed tools to tell when something's not actually used?
I think so. I think that's generally true, more true at least. But you know, static typing sort of falls off in certain cases anyway. Like, you know, you get like when you get down to the HTML and like CSS and JavaScript.
Yeah, you were just using like Platinum Searcher or something like
that. Yeah, yeah. For the most time, I just sort of grep the repo and just figure out what's going on there. And
on the other end, I'm thinking about Ruby's metaprogramming where your actual method names can be created at runtime, just stringing some keywords together. Like, we've been enjoying the Ransat gem lately, and there's all kinds of magic methods and tables and things put together. And
enjoying, yes.
I don't know. I guess that probably segues into another point that unit testing is maybe more popular in the Ruby community than in some of the statically typed language communities because you don't have that safety net of the compiler. You can type anything you want and push it to production and not know that you've broken something until an hour or a week later when someone uses that. small pieces. Like he's,
and it's not compiled, right? So like you don't get the compiler to tell you that, hey, this symbol does not exist.
Exactly.
It has to run that exact page in that exact scenario for you to hit that. So I do think that's why a lot of the dynamic languages have a lot bigger testing community, and they're easier to test because they're dynamic as well. There's less ceremony around getting tests to work in a dynamic language just because of generally how they're built. But having said that, JavaScript testing is still not like super popular, and it's very dynamic. And of all the languages that need a lot of testing, JavaScript's probably like one of the top ones.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of user group talks on QUnit, I think, like jQuery unit testing, and it seemed pretty nice. I don't recall ever having done it afterwards, but
there's a lot of movement there to do a lot of JavaScript testing. But I would say out of like code bases of like percentage not tested of like of dynamic languages, JavaScript would be pretty high on the list. And it's just really bad because it runs in like your browser where no one sees it.
Right.
Most of the time. I mean, obviously you have Node.js, but like if you write a bad Ruby script and it fails, at least you're going to see it in your error logs eventually.
Right. And that's
where that's not true in JavaScript. You'll just have this thing that you thought was working forever until someone actually calls you on the phone or emails you and says, hey, this screen that used to work doesn't work anymore. Unless you're doing JavaScript logging, but if you're not doing testing, you're probably not doing JavaScript logging either.
I've seen people who do JavaScript logging and maybe even some exception handling, and they centralize it. So one thing we do on all of our projects here is we'll have a centralized exception tracking web service. So when a production or staging web app dies on one page or one action, you'll get a stack trace, everything that went wrong, and hopefully the lines of code that were being executed when it went wrong. That'll show up in a centralized web app that will track when it happened, what the inputs were, how often it's happened. And that way we can, as a team, we can go find it and look it up. And it provides a nice interface for managing those. So you can say this error has happened 1,000 times in the last week.
Yeah, velocity and things like that. Those tools have really improved. And we can mention some of the ones here, like Raygun and Sentry.
Yeah.
There's some other ones for like mobile iOS and Android that I've used in the past. I can't recall the names right now. So sorry to the guys who build those great apps. I just don't remember what they're called. But they all sort of have the same premise of centralized error logging. And a lot of them you can upload your, if you're doing a static language, you can upload your debugging symbols so that you can get like good stack traces and things like that. And for the ones that are scripts, they're usually pretty self-explanatory. But doing the velocity of like this error happened X many times over the last minute, super valuable for keeping your uptime for production.
Yeah. He's not here right now, but one thing Mo mentioned to me when we were talking about production error logging recently is that when you first get into that, maybe you haven't had that type of tool before, it's tempting to try to fix all the errors. But realistically, it becomes more of a triage situation because unless you're in some situation where your job is just to wait for errors and fix them, you're almost certainly going to be utilized for more ongoing development or supporting something else. So there's definitely some ROI considerations for every specific error. Like if you see this little used feature dies once a month, then the person who's using it doesn't even use the app very often. That kind of, you don't want to just write them off entirely, but if you compare that to something that dies every other page load and it's obviously tied to a serious revenue, then you're going to look at that one first.
Yeah. It is really hard to add some of these things that we're going to talk about to an existing product.
Yeah.
And like you said, actually, a lot of these the sort of error tracking software has sort of leaned towards what you're talking about as far as like issues will auto resolve themselves if they haven't been seen in X many, you know, days.
Yeah.
And that's super useful for existing projects because as soon as you add it, error logging, you're going to see a bunch of errors. And if you haven't seen that error in a month, it's probably not worth your investment unless it's, like you said, a critical part of the system. You know, you don't want to ignore errors in your transaction, your financial transaction code or anything like that. But that poor guy's JavaScript that might have been caused by an extension on his side of the browser, you don't really want to put your developers on it for like days at a time trying to hunt it down.
Right. So Jesse, you were discussing source control earlier, and that kind of had me leaning towards some of the next points on our list here. With a source control system, it's really ideal for you to set up a deterministic, mostly automated deployment system. So if you have a very good log of the code and every line that's changed and when and by whom, then you can and should build your application testing and deployment process around that source control.
Yeah.
So it's not just like, oh, once a week we have, or I guess
we have our build guy, like pull it all together and throw it out on staging and like hope for the best. Yeah. Continuous delivery, and or continuous deployment. They're sort of sort of tie together. Continuous deployment is more what you're talking about, I think, but it sort of builds off of continuous integration. Mm-hmm. You have to have both those pieces. So for those who are uninformed, continuous integration is normally where, like you said, you have a source control system and you have a set of build commands that run every time a new commit has been pushed to your production branch, whatever that may be, master, default, depending on if you're using Mercurial or Git or whatever system you're using, and building it. And then the continuous deployment part of that is taking those build artifacts and throwing them up on a test server, at least a test server, right? You know, I won't get into the pros and cons of auto-deploying to production, I don't think. Like that, it varies from, like, you know, market to market. Like, you don't want to auto-deploy bank software necessarily. There has to be sign-offs on, like, you know, compliance and things like that. But if you're building GitHub, it's fine to auto deploy all day, every day. They deploy, I forget how many times a day. It's many, like in the teens, if not like, you know, more than that.
The only way I've seen auto deployment in production that seems sane was if you have some automated detection and rollback of problems. Like if this, like you only auto deploy one thing at a time and you check and see if your error rate spikes, then it'll automatically pull back and you'll get alerted. You don't want to just have things sneaking out and maybe your developer's too busy programming to notice that they broke the live site, right?
Yep. Yeah. It's always good to have some smoke test in a lower environment that's not your production test production system. But yeah. So yeah, continuous deployment. Some tools around that for those who aren't familiar, I guess, like you've got Heroku pipelines if you're a Heroku fan. If you're on Azure, like they have direct Git support in some of their things. So like web applications on I think they still call them web applications. They've changed names so many times in Azure that I can't even keep up. But they used to be called web applications. You can just add it as a remote. Mm-hmm. And you can do the same for Heroku as well, right? So you can actually just get pushed to like Azure / you know, deployment, and it'll automatically build it and deploy it for you. If it's within their sort of realm of like technology stack that they like. For a more manual process or legacy where you've got like a bunch of servers that you're maintaining yourself, things like Octopus Deploy. I've had great luck with them in the past. I think they used to be Redgate Deploy or something at some point. But basically you just have a little service that runs on all your nodes, and then you just, you know, communicates and pushes down zip files and lets you run whatever scripts you want, bash scripts, PowerShell scripts, depending on your environment. So yeah, those are super important to having trust in your entire system.
Yeah, and I honestly wonder if we haven't gone straight into the technology and maybe not talked enough about
the why.
What happens when you're on a team that doesn't have, I mean, let's say you're on a team that uses Subversion or Git, but doesn't have continuous integration or continuous deployment. Like, what does your life look like? Well, let's say you have a 3-month project and you don't have continuous integration and deployment. Like, what do you think the common failure cases and scenarios are going to be, like, where if you had been doing it with these automated tools, it might have helped you?
What I've seen fail the most is the deployment guy has left the company. Like, those are literally, I mean, it's sort of the guy got hit by the bus, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's sort of the thing that you're trying to avoid. Like, you don't want to rely on a guy to know how to build the server. Mm-hmm. You want to rely on code that's also in source control, by the way, most of the time, right? You want to keep your build scripts. Like, it's nice to use all these proprietary systems like, you know, Atlassian's build server. Great stuff, right? But at the same time, you really want to call into your own makefile or your own script so that while you're versioning your code, your actual, like, build script is versioning along with it. So when the next guy who, like, you know, Atlassian's thing goes down and you need to set up a build server, maybe they don't want to pay for it anymore or whatever, you've got, you know, it's pretty much just calling this one script.
Right.
And then, and then from there, everything's good. But yeah, so instead of relying on a guy who used to know how to build the system who now has left and started his own company or whatever, now you've got a source of truth of how that's supposed to happen and why it used to happen, hopefully, right? You've got comments in the Git or in the commit logs to, you know, tell you why suddenly you're installing, you know, Node.js on the server. It's like, oh, because we're rendering React on the server. But if you didn't have the history of that, you wouldn't know that that's a dependency. So you wouldn't be able to set up that environment from fresh again.
Yeah, we kind of split the difference for one of our current Ruby projects where we have the tests are all written in Ruby. We should probably write some in JavaScript too. But we have the Ruby tests, and then we have small scripts that run the test suite, and then those we run those locally by hand when we're testing our own code before we commit it and push it up. But also on the build server itself, it does really simple stuff like install Ruby version 2, install Node version 6, install all the gems, install all the Node packages, and then run this one build command. So that is not technically under source control, but it's the three steps we can put in the README, so it's good enough for me.
I thought we put that in a makefile.
We have a makefile, yeah, and the makefile streamlines. Yeah, but still, I did log into a web app and type in make in the text box for how does your build work, right? Yeah. I mean, we didn't automate the install Ruby and install Node parts, but yeah.
Right. I think that's why Docker is becoming very popular as well. It's sort of, you know, we've had Puppet and Chef for years, and Docker is sort of like a new version of those sort of same ideas where like the actual environment system is documented in this very easy to read text format. So that you actually have the environment and how, and those things, like you said, like, oh yeah, in order to do this, we need to actually install Node.js version 6 on the server.
Right. And that gets back to what I was saying earlier about determinism, which just to explain what I mean in this context, it's when you look at the script that runs something, you should be able to say it will do exactly this every time. So recently on our big Ruby project, we've migrated from NPM to the Yarn package manager, which is basically a drop-in replacement for NPM. It supports most of the same commands. It does all the same stuff, but it also brings in a Yarn lock file. So apparently NPM would go and try to find the packages you wanted, but you couldn't actually tell until it was done exactly what the results would be, because you had imprecise specifications of which version of which package you wanted. So with a lock file, you can say, yeah, I said I wanted version 6. whatever, and when I last ran this and it succeeded, it found 6.0.1. So we're going to use 6.0.1 until someone has a reason to change it. So you can kind of have it both ways, where you don't have to be super precise up front when asking for what you want, but the tool still stores exactly what it found so that you have a known good state to build from.
Yeah,
and that's what I mean by determinism. You run a package JSON file through NPM, it's not deterministic. But if you run it through Yarn, you should get the same thing every time, unless, of course, the file host disappeared and the particular version you're looking for is gone. But at least you know what should be there, even if it's not.
So, Daniel, I think you asked a really important question earlier about... So I think you kicked all this whole conversation off with saying these are some kind of code quality build tool type things that if I came into a project and I didn't see these, I would be really surprised. Or I would struggle a little bit to get things done. And so you asked a little bit earlier about what does it look like if we don't have these and how does that affect your job? And I'd love to revisit that in a little bit more detail.
So personally, I think I've internalized a lot of my preferences and past good and bad experiences around teams and tools. If I'm working on a project that is doing multiple commits or pushes to your source control every day, they're being tested with real unit tests, they're being deployed to staging every time it's merged in, then I feel like that gets close to my personal mantra when I'm working on any kind of project, especially a new project, is every day of the project, I want to tell myself, if we had to launch this tomorrow, we could do it. And I often get in projects where people want to focus on the features, like, here's our list of 50 things we want to build for this new release that's going out however many weeks or months away. We'll do those now, and then when the time comes, we'll spend the time and money to set up a staging server and a test server and a production server, and we're going to estimate that's going to take 3 weeks and everything's going to be fine. Just based on past experience, I like to get to the point where you put all the pieces in place, you make them work, you automate as much of the testing and deployment as possible, and then you start layering on one feature or one fix at a time on top of that. And that's more of the... We use Scrum here, and I like it, but I think the way I feel sometimes is more of a extreme programming methodology where you have 24-hour cycles or less. You do one thing. When it's done, you integrate it, make sure it's good, then you do the next thing.
So just briefly, this is exactly what I was hoping to get into. And I think from my perspective, as one who is really excited about more of the feature set and maybe even reporting side of things sometimes. Right. It's a source of assurance to be doing these things because I can know as I'm doing feature dev that if I do something I shouldn't have done, if the tests are in place or if the continuous deployment's in place in such a way that I'll be alerted or the team will be alerted immediately if I screw something up that I shouldn't have, that's a real source of assurance for me as I'm doing sort of the feature development work, even reporting type stuff, where we'll know immediately what broke, why it broke, who made the change. And it's just really helpful to be coding with that in mind because I don't have to be kind of in a constant state of worry or panic about those kind of things breaking.
So as a developer, the more automated and transparent your test and build and deploy process is, the more faith you can have that it's going to still work when you turn around and do something else for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've worked in past jobs where we didn't have plain text source. I'd be building reports or applications in drag and drop builders, and the results would be stored off in some binary format that I couldn't see inside of. All I could do was load it up inside the editor, went through a session, think I was happy with it, and save it. There was no regression testing. There was no source control. And that was really hard. Some days it feels like you're gaslighting yourself. Like, I thought I was here, and now I spent this many hours pushing it forward, and somehow I'm back to worse than I was when I started. So I wound up, when I control the servers, I'd copy off the entire application directory before a major session because worst case, I can roll it back just by reloading the files. But when I worked on an SAP reporting system 5-10 years ago, we had some backup capacity, but really it was more like we go through 5 different environments from pre-dev to dev to sandbox to staging to production. So if it gets broken in one, I'm just hoping it's good in one of the others. Like, maybe I screw up the copy in development and ask somebody to send back the copy in staging.
At a level, it's kind of risk management too, if I can use that phrase, because you're saying what we're trying to do in all of this is cut down on variables that could change without us knowing it, and then thereby, I think, lower the risk of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, it helps you to plan your short-term work, and it helps you to better make really detailed, really accurate plans and really strong commitments and build trust with each other and your stakeholders.
Yeah.
If you can't be confident that your build and your test are going to work the same way week to week, you can't really make very accurate estimations about work. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something that you're pretty sure you know how to do, it could go wrong in a lot of ways beyond your control. So a lot of this is just about minimizing uncertainty in the process.
So let's talk about testing. We've mentioned it a lot, but haven't really dove into it yet.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to test. Yeah. So, you know, I'll stick to sort of what we mostly do here, or what we've been doing, is Ruby. So Ruby obviously has unit tests and integration tests. So for those who aren't familiar, unit tests, you just sort of have a module, let's say a calculator, and you just test all the methods that, you know, you assert that if you call the add function with 1 and 1, that is 2 when it's done. Yeah.
So that's testing in isolation.
Yeah, testing in isolation, yep. Yeah, and integration testing is normally where there's varying levels of degrees of integration testing. The most basic form is sort of the same thing, where you're like, hey, I want to make sure that when I save a person record with first name and last name, you want to assert that maybe the SPROC was called that actually does the work. Or maybe you want to assert that, you know, if you're doing something funny with the database where, like, you enter their birthday, but you're also go ahead and denormalizing their age to another column, and you're doing that in some, like, before save call in Rails, you would want to assert that after saving the birth date, you know, year of 85, that, you know, they're going to equal that they're going to equal the right age when you actually assert it. That's integration test because you're testing the database. Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, that's probably a poor example because the database isn't the one actually doing the work. But you get the idea of, like, you want to actually start integrating in the parts of your system that aren't just the code, which is the database, your Reddit installation, Redis installation, not your Reddit installation. You can install Reddit. It is open source, but I don't recommend, like, integrating in any of your product, I don't think.
You don't have any Python right now.
Yeah. But yeah, exactly. If you've got Redis, databases, or even just the browser. So those are sort of, I usually call them, like, smoke test or, like, browser test, but those are a form of integration test where you've actually spun up a browser of some sort. There's ways to do it headless, which means you don't actually see the frame, or you can actually, like, control a browser as well and actually see what's going on. And all the browser vendors, now that Safari has finally fallen in line, all hook up to a web driver specification. And so you've got tools like PhantomJS and Selenium that work different ways, but I think they all sort of work off of the WebDriver protocol, where the code, you write code that controls a browser. So you can say, hey, click this button.
This invisible browser that goes and clicks and types and does the real user experience, but you don't have to have it plugged into a video card.
Exactly, and they do crazy good things like taking screenshots when cases fail. So it's great. So you're like, hey, I want to click this button. And then if you get a failure, at least you can look at the screenshot and be like, oh, that button wasn't there. Whoops. Like, you know, like, I see what happened. I renamed the button and broke it. And that's one thing about the test sort of test flow, unit versus integration. Integration tests, by the virtue that they actually integrate other things, they become way more brittle than unit tests. You want to try to break your code into small testable chunks of work that don't rely on that and keep your integration tests sort of as thin but as important as they need to be, because they are way more brittle, especially when you get to that far end of like browser testing. Because a lot of times you have to write crazy selectors. You know, you're like, all right, yeah, I have this button that's a primary button. You start using, like, you know, your CSS classes to say this exact button with the text of save should be clicked. And then some business owner comes around and says, like, that button needs to be, you know, continue. And, like, suddenly you're like, oh, man, all my tests fail. Like, oh, that's terrible. And so it's important to know that. But it just means that there is a lot more churn on those sort of tests than there are unit tests.
Yeah, in my experience, I usually have a good 10 times more unit tests than integration tests. The integration tests for me are just, like you said, smoke tests. You find some of the core interactions of the application or product and make sure that no matter what you do, you don't break them. And something I was thinking about when you described that is, to me, an integration test is do what I mean, or a unit test is do what I say. Like, if you've properly broken your methods down into small pieces, there shouldn't be any ambiguity. It could be like the call bin at the home phone method. Like, that's hard to get wrong. But if it's like the call bin method, then, or talk to bin method, then that could be anything. There's talk to bin page. So that's do what I mean is very imprecise. The user doesn't know or care about what's under the hood. They just have a specific action they want to perform in a context. So as a logged in administrator, I want to be able, or non-administrator, I want to be able to do this. And a unit test might get you there. But, integration test. Unit test would be all the little pieces.
That distinction is really helpful. I was just going to ask if that's a Daniel Pritchett original, or if you got that from a 15-year-old blog post somewhere that we should link in the show notes.
I've certainly heard the phrases "do what I mean" and "do what I say" used in different contexts. I don't know if it was testing the last time I thought about it, but it seems relevant here.
It's still really helpful. I thought that was a really great overview too, Jesse, of just different types of testing, how they are different, how they are similar, why we would do them, and what they accomplish for us. I was thinking too of, a lot of this is a source of assurance, as we talked about earlier. It's also a source of huge time savings when you're talking about testing, because, I mean, I can even remember times where either at old jobs or old projects where every time to test it, you've got to boot up the app. And that just is, I mean, it's just crippling in terms of time it takes for a developer to be doing things like that.
Yeah, but you can get into a case, you know, to play devil's advocate here. A lot of people don't do testing, and they like to do the browser testing, and a lot of times they like it because that's what their users are going to do.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said about doing a lot of unit tests, and then the app still doesn't work.
Yeah,
that's true. So you there's definitely a line there that we have to you know, tread carefully on to make sure that we're not, you know, spending, you know, weeks writing all these unit tests, and then turns out we don't have any integration test, and so everything's not hooked up quite right. The little Legos work together, but if you don't have the final assembly right, then it doesn't mean anything. The product doesn't work.
So the dev only console app sometimes won't get us to the finish line.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That's a great point, Jesse.
That's one of the reasons I don't make as many integration tests, because they have to be, they're more brittle, they also tend to run slower. Like, in the context of a test runner, just doing a single method, like, make sure assert 1 + 1 = 2 is milliseconds, but actually firing up a web page and clicking through and hitting submit could be 2 seconds. And a big part of all of this is improving team leverage. Like, if I put in some time building a better test suite or a better build strategy, then every developer who wants to submit a change can have it hopefully tested within a matter of seconds or minutes, depending on the size of the project, and then deployed to a staging server. So they get fast feedback, and that's really what we're looking for. It's really common in startup circles to say that people should do their best to fail fast. Like, if your startup idea is not going to ever sell in the market, you should try to find that out immediately and not 18 months in when you've wasted millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's like a whole nother conversation, but it's really interesting because there's a lot of things you can do to see whether your product has even a slice of the pie that you're actually looking for,
right?
By just like, you know, selling ads and like things like that that don't act with before actually building a product. But that's like a whole nother conversation.
Oh, yeah.
All at some point. But yeah, I mean, same thing. Like, don't invest too much into it until you know that it's worth it. And so that's how you get in these situations where you don't have any test as well.
Yeah.
It happens a lot, pretty much all the time, honestly.
So yeah, you, as a developer, getting immediate feedback, knowing when something you've done has broken something is important, because that way you maybe won't spend a few more days embellishing it before you break, you fix the thing you broke.
Yep.
And having that automated integration really allows the team to scale up their efforts. Like, going from, if you have one developer that's owning a web app by themselves, trying to bring in 10 more developers when you're not using source control or a test suite or even a build server, it's going to be really hard. I mean, if you're running a project with 10 people and they're all submitting pull requests, if you're lucky, the pull request might look good to you as the reviewer, but you can't tell by looking at it if it's going to break the app sometimes. So that's a huge benefit to possible team throughput.
Yeah, it's really, like you said, a lot of reason we test is to actually speed up development as developers. Like, that's what we're really after, or that's what I'm after most of the time, is to prove that it works without me having to switch over to my browser or this application and go through 10 screens to get there.
Right.
What's interesting about that, I guess, is that we, there's the other side where people don't want to develop integration tests because they feel like it slows them down.
Right.
Which I don't think is really true, but it is true if you don't know Selenium, right? Yeah. Or you don't know Capybara or whatever it is, right? The other one, all these headless tools. Like, it's a lot harder to write those sort of tests than it is to actually just test it the first time.
Right.
And so then someone's like, oh, it worked, I'm done.
Yeah.
And so, like, it is slower in that sense, but the next guy who needs to make one tweak to it, he has to actually go through and understand your code, understand what it used to do, and make his tweak and understand that his tweak worked without actually having the assertions of what it used to do, like, clear in his head necessarily. Right. And
potentially,
so
every person has to pay the overhead every single time.
So, yeah,
and that's where the time savings really is.
Part of that could just be code quality. Testing does a lot to promote good code quality, just because for various reasons, testable code tends to be readable code and well-composed code. But also, if I'm writing Ruby tests, I'm writing them in Ruby, I should use properly sized and structured modules. I should use comments. I should use meaningful names.
Yeah.
So if I write a test that technically validates what I wanted to validate, but you guys come behind me a week later and can't tell how it's doing what it's doing, then it's really not great test code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what helps with that, and I think that's kind of what you're segueing into, is like linters, as they're called now, right? You've got JavaScript linters, Ruby linters. ReSharper, for those who are in .NET, is sort of like a linter in that.
Sort of.
I mean, so the idea behind linters, for those who aren't informed, is it basically outputs things that could be better based on rule sets, like in your code. So it runs against a file and says, hey, this variable's not used, or hey, this function is way too long. You know, the complexity level is like way higher than it should be. You should think about breaking in other methods and things like that, right? Formatting, and these rules are all configurable. For JavaScript, a lot of people like to lean on the Airbnb Teams thing. That's what we lean on here. For those who aren't aware, the Airbnb has a giant JavaScript, lint rule set that sort of matches the latest and greatest of ES6 stuff or 25, ECMA 2015, whatever they want to call it.
Yeah.
And same thing for Ruby. You've got Rubocop, which is its linter. And there's linters for everything.
Yeah, that's great. The thing about Airbnb, like, a key skill for engineering is delegating decision making or delegating taste. If I've not done enough hours of JavaScript or JavaScript style decision making in my career to really have a nuanced opinion on what good JavaScript looks like at the linter level, I'm more than happy to use somebody else's opinions until I come up with a reason not to like them.
Yep, for sure.
And it's great to be able to pull that out. I mean, that's one of the reasons Rails is so successful. That's one of the reasons, or a major reason, it can be hard for somebody to get into, say, web development in Node, is because you have to make more decisions up front. Maybe the same thing with React is, possibly a composed React solution with these 17 modules is going to be ideal for your problem, but somebody off the street who just heard React was cool and wants to use it is not going to have as many decent decisions made for them ahead of time as you get with like Rails or say the lint file there.
Yeah, and I think we're, as a developer industry, we're heading towards more opinionated, even for the dynamic languages. Like, you know, Facebook's been pushing their like scaffolding for Create React app, I think is what the NPM module is. And it comes bundled with a set of rules that they follow at Facebook or that they think everyone else should follow by like the minimum standard.
Yeah.
And it does things like at least making sure that you're not making tiny mistakes. It doesn't, because JavaScript doesn't compile. It doesn't, you know, it's not actually compiling JavaScript, but it's looking at things and making sure that you're not defining variables that shouldn't be used. And, you know, they're not getting crazy with exactly where the braces should be, I don't think, in some cases. They may be for their rule set, but like they're not trying to make everything really opinionated. They're just trying to make sure you don't make dumb mistakes.
Right.
And by basically, it's sort of like a static analyzer, right? They're just trying to do as little as possible to make sure that you're falling into good patterns.
Well, I was just going to say, while we're, as we're kind of wrapping this one up and coming to our close time, Daniel's so sad he wants to record for longer. I do love doing this podcast, but I think it would be helpful for listeners and maybe even for ourselves to just give some really practical examples of things we've seen. And since I'm putting you guys on the spot, I'll go first. One thing I was thinking of in terms of code quality and build tools and things like that, I think here we've been working really hard, especially lately, to just you know, motivate a culture of code quality. So even just really simple things like putting code climate in and then kind of ragging on each other when when the percentage coverage goes down. And we've had lots of conversations, you know, about how much can we actually trust that percentage number and what are their metrics. And really, you know, that's a totally different conversation.
That's a healthy conversation.
It is.
Good. The tool made us have it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good conversation for sure. But just even being able to see proportionally, we went up some percentage or we went down some percentage and then responding positively or negatively and that motivating us to do it better next time. I think that's really a helpful and practical, simple thing that, that folks can do.
Yeah. I think that's why linters are important, is what you were saying. It makes you have that conversation.
Yeah.
You may not care about two spaces versus four spaces or whatever, or tabs versus spaces, but the guy who comes in after you might. And it's just, instead of him just doing his own thing when he comes in and things looking different from file to file or method to method, I really don't like going into a code base and being able to tell who coded it. So linters really make that feel like an actual, like, you know, a thing. You know, I can still tell sometimes, but with variable names and method names. But like the general stylistic choices of like one individual, like, shouldn't just be like sprinkled throughout an entire code base, you know. And so it makes you have that conversation of like, well, what do we like as a team? Like, some guy got outvoted. He may be annoyed for like a day, but like at the end of the day, he'll set up his text editor to format it the way everyone else wanted it, so that the linter doesn't complain and you'll never hear about it again.
Yeah, that the one great thing about linters or style tools in general is when you're doing code review, it is great to have the nitpicky stuff handled by a tool.
Yeah.
So let's say Ben likes four spaces and you like two spaces in your Ruby, even though two spaces is the Ruby community standard. It would be terrible if every time Ben submitted a major feature change, your first comment was, oh, you need to use two spaces instead of four.
Yeah, that would be terrible.
So we have tools to tell us that.
Yeah, so we can focus on the business rules and stuff when it comes in.
You might have to fight that battle once when you add the rule to the linter. Like, okay, Jesse's putting his foot down. We're going to be a two spaces team now. But once we get through that, you don't have to. That doesn't have to be like a constant point of contention for everybody. And it lets you have more exchange of ideas. And
you only have to bring it up every retrospective.
Yeah, right.
Can we change that rule? No.
Yeah. Exactly. So it allows you to do your work without having so much unhealthy conflict.
Yep, exactly.
My big advice here is just incremental improvement. I love working on tools for teams, especially a Rails team, because I've got a lot of opinions on things that have worked in the past. But Jesse mentioned that something like integration tests, people shy away because they're not really sure how to do it. And that gets to my favorite point about any kind of build or code quality change, is you don't have to do the whole thing all at once. And honestly, you can't. If you're on a project that doesn't have source control, start doing it on your own box. Just check the whole thing into a local Git repo. Maybe put it in a private Git repo too, and you can work on getting it out to the whole team later. But let's say you've got Git, but you don't have a test harness. You can set up a single file, especially in a Rails project, that runs a single test. And that test doesn't even have to be real. It can just be assert that the test harness didn't blow up. And then you can run that yourself. And then a week later, you make a meaningful test. Same thing with the deployment. You know, you can set up a simple deployment system, and you can just build the stuff up one piece at a time. Like, I love putting Sidekick in every Rails project. So that's one of the first things I do. I mean, I'll set up the test suite, write the first test, set up the background jobs, make sure they run properly, write the first background job, and just move on. Because having that little beachhead lets the next person who has a legitimate need, which always comes up in any project that lasts for more than a couple of weeks in Ruby, you're going to need tests, you're going to need a background job. It lets them do the work without having to deal with that initial friction of getting it up and running. So never feel like you can't get from zero tests to 1,000. Just get from zero tests to one.
Great advice.
Good conversation, guys.
All right, we'll see you guys next time.
You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by Clear Function. Clear Function is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.